Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen and I'm here to talk to Kate Atkinson about her novel Behind the Scenes at the Museum, which it's extraordinary to think, I hadn't realised when I first read it, that it was Kate's first novel, because I guess although it has a lot of the, perhaps the sort of gusto that you sometimes especially associate with first novels, it's also extraordinarily formally kind of confident as well as elaborate and intricate. And indeed, the good news, not just for Kate, but for our nation's youth, is that it's about to be an A-level set text. Yes. We're all happy about that, I think. We all somehow feel vindicated by that. And and I think, you know, it'll be because of its formal intricacy and delight in design, it will, I'm sure, be a particularly delightful book and perhaps also quite an easy book to teach, if not an easy book to study. And despite its intricacy, there's something, if I may dwell, I warned Kate I'd do this, on a little, small, short anecdote from my own family history, as this is a book so much about family history. This, my mother, who's sadly dead now, was a great reader, but almost never read novels, which she felt bore only ever a rather distant relationship with real life.
That's true.
And and yet this was a novel, before I'd actually read it, quite a long time ago, after it first came out, I think the idiom is she banged on about it. She didn't just recommend it, she banged on about it. And I said to her, this is very peculiar, because I thought you didn't like novels. And she said, oh dear, it's not like other novels. I mean, it's all like a wonderful family history. It's not like those made up plots, it's like those other books I read, which aren't novels at all. And I said, well, I've read reviews of it. They all say it's sort of a bit like Tristram Shandy. And they all talk about its literary experimentalism. She said, oh, no. She said, it's a lovely, great, long family history. And that's why it's so good. And then she said, and this is a cunning way, it's my first question. Then she said, there's only one peculiar thing about it. She said, it's got an odd title. And she admitted, or she said as if it weren't important, I don't understand why it's called this, but it's a wonderful book, never mind about that. So I feel I'm sort of duty bound, really, to start.
On behalf of your mother.
To start with, I mean, I have my, you know, I have my theories about the title, but I wondered if, I mean, it is a sort of, I suppose, what I kind of, to coin a phrase, I call it a puzzle title. One of those books, one of those novels, which have a title which makes you think, oh, I've got to work out what the title is. I mean, you know, that's, I don't know, The Line of Beauty is a bit like that, and you have an explanation on page 179, finally, or, I don't know, we did recently Hideous Kinky. You pick that up in the bookshop, and you know you're going to have to read a bit to find out what it means. So,
Do you feel that I explain it at some point in the book?
I don't feel you explain it. I don't feel, I mean, unlike the two examples I've mentioned, which do actually give quite, in a way, quite straightforward explanations, although they leave you to then test how appropriate the title still is. But with Behind the Scenes at the Museum, you don't, as it were, get the phrase behind
it's
the
not as baffling as Emotionally Weird, which I see you have a copy of.
Yes. Well, I guess the difference in Emotionally Weird is that's a kind of idiom in a way, which I might have heard people say, whereas behind the scenes at the museum sounds like something that has been very much coined for the occasion. And I guess you tell me. I won't. Well, Why did you think of that title?
I had a dream. I had a dream, which is in the book, at some point, very near the end. I think possibly when Ruby's... in that kind of coma she goes into. I think she dreams that she's in York Castle Museum and that it's she's walking through it in the dark at night and she's on her own and everything in the museum comes to life, which I think was, for me, a slight echo of... There's a children's book called, by Jan Pienkowski called The Haunted House, which is a pop-up book, and you go through it and everything pops up on every page. And it was very like that, but you would, you know, you'd... Because I don't know if you know York Castle Museum, which is possibly the best museum in the world, next to York Railway Museum. And it's very much a museum about how people lived, and it's a series of rooms and streets, so that you really, very, very atmospheric. And as a child, because I went there from a very, very early age, my father used to take me from when I can't remember. I mean, I know I've been going there all my life. And it still has that same feeling. It's still a very, very people-friendly museum. But you see how people live because you walk through the streets. You know, it used to have big stuffed horses that were pulling the carriages. And I noticed last time I was there that the horses were now plastic, which was very sad, I thought. So not, presumably all the stuffed cats and the stuffed dogs are all now not real stuffed cats and stuffed dogs. That used to fascinate me that these things were real. So it had informed my imagination as a place from a very early age. And I had this dream. It was very vivid. I very rarely remember dreams at all. I'm really rubbish at dreams. But in this dream, as I walked through, there was a fire in a grate in one of the rooms that flared up. And something, one of the animals came to life and something else. Lots and lots of things as I walked through. There's a series of these things coming to life. And I woke up, and I swear this is the only time this has ever happened to me in my life. The dream had a title, and I thought, that dream was called Behind the Scenes at the Museum. And I was probably about, I didn't have a publisher for the book at that point. No, the book wasn't written. The book was just a series of chapters that were sort of being written as stories. And I thought, that's a good title for the book. That is the title for the book, I thought. So I think my imagination, my subconscious, and were working at a very deep level with each other and my dreaming states, so that, and it made sense to me, because it didn't make sense to me at the time, but it makes sense to me now, because I can see that it's about personal history as opposed to public history, so that there's a great sweep of things that have happened in Britain. There's the First World War, there's the Second World War, there's the post-war period, which are large public events and years that we've gone through. And behind it are much more parochial stories about individuals and how they've reacted to. And in a way, you know, when you see public history, there's a lot of propaganda involved in it, whereas people's individual stories are actually much more, in a way, kind of meaner in many ways. They don't have the heroism of the public stories, I think, a lot of the time. So that it's about what goes on behind the facade, what's presented to us as, you know, here's the museum, these are the objects, what happens behind. And of course, the whole book is about objects, it's about things, it's entirely about things. It's about finding a place for things and what things represent. And museums are also about things. And I think it's, for me, sounds ridiculous, things are important. I like stuff, I like things, I like objects, I always have done. My house, if you could see, it's just full of things that have, for me, great emotional resonance, whereas my mother's the complete opposite. My mother doesn't have any attachment to things whatsoever, which in one sense is very zen, and another is very, very annoying. So that, but for me, you know, I will look at an object in my house and think, oh, that reminds me of because I got it then, and it, you know, I mean, I'm the person who every place I go has to buy a fridge magnet and a Christmas decoration, so that every time I look at my fridge, I think, oh, that's that we got that when we went to Amsterdam, or, you know, oh, that's that ridiculous Christmas decoration I got in Milwaukee in that shop. So that things to me are freighted with meaning. And I think in the book, that's what ties a lot of things, well, a lot of things are tied, such a useful word thing, are tied together by that, those objects. And for me, you know, they do carry their stories, and they're often mysterious, like not in the book, I don't think, or maybe in the book. My father had an Edward VII coronation, an Edward VIII, sorry, Edward VIII coronation jug. It is in the book, isn't it? Which was made before he abdicated. And I always used to find that fascinating, that, you know, that this represented something that never happened. But also my father said that he'd bought it cheaply when he was working in a greengrocer's. Just a grocer's, I think, that he was working in after he came up from the pit. So he'd do a full shift in the pit, and then he went and worked in this grocer's, but they'd had money off this souvenir object and that he bought it then. So there's lots of things, again, the public and the private history that's all mixed up in these objects.
I suppose the funny thing is in the novel, maybe this is one of the pleasures of writing a novel as well as reading it, is that some of these things, I don't know, the rabbit's foot that the narrator's mother is clutching when she gives birth, all the sort of all these buttons, or the photographs, lots of photographs, is that you say they're freighted with meaning and their meaning is mysterious. But I guess there may be exceptions to this. That one thing about the novel is that, especially the sort of narrative method you use, we find out sort of what the meaning of these things is. And quite often we may have to wait quite a long time before we do it, but it's like behind the scenes at the museum, it's a sort of promise that you will find out in a way that you never would, as it were, normally, isn't it?
Yes, because you're told everything before it happens, really, so that the surprises are kept hidden, and the things that should be surprises are actually revealed, I think.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a bit about that, actually, because there's sort of two kind of contrary things that you seem to do, it seems to me. On the one hand, there are, if you like, mysteries with clues sometimes, and there's two different kinds of clues. There's ones which even I got when I first read it, and there's ones which I only got when I read it for the second time. And then there's sort of the opposite of mysteries and clues. They're things you don't need to tell us in advance, but that you do choose to tell us in advance.
Like what?
Well, you say things like Gillian.
Oh, Gillian's
dead. You're talking right very early on in the novel, in the first chapter. The narrator is talking rather sardonically about this rather difficult and selfish sister. And then she suddenly says in brackets, and then she would be run over in, what is it, 1961? I can't remember. I've got the reference.
By a blue Hillman Husky.
Yes. And you think, hang on, my goodness. Yes, here we are. Clean and new as a pin or an unwrapped bar of soap. She also represents, this is Gillian, everything they fought the war for, our Gillian, the promise of the future. Open brackets. Not much of a future, as it turned out. You see, yes, it's funny, but it's terrible. She gets run over. You know, it's like, which is the funniest child death in literature? I mean, and surely this is close to Little Nell, isn't it? Not much of a future, as it turned out, as she gets run over by a pale blue Hillman Husky in 1959. But how are any of us to know this? As a family, we are genetically predisposed towards having accidents. Being run over and blown up are the two most common.
Both my grandfathers were blown up, which I always thought was a very bizarre thing, and I think that that informed that passage in a way. It was almost as if they were in there being blown up by... One of them was blown up by a stray bomb, and one of them was blown up in a pit explosion. But so I never knew my grandparents, my grandfathers. But the fact that they were both blown up, I always thought was very strange. And that was that sense of genetic predisposition, because I used to think, am I genetically predisposed to be blown up?
But what about Gillian? What about? I mean, I love your brackets. I love the narrator's brackets,
I really try to ration my brackets these days.
I think there's actually somewhere, there's a thing by Virginia Woolf, a bit more solemn in tone, where she says she tries to ration her brackets as well.
It's very difficult.
Because she likes parentheses.
Yes.
What was the devil that came over you that made you want to tell us about Julia? I mean, and there's quite a lot of you tell us that Ada's going to die of diphtheria a long time before the chapter where she does die of diphtheria. There's lots of little sections where you say, and what will happen to these children? Well, I'll just tell you now, at the end of chapter one. And they're sad things, they're sad, they're always sad things, and yet somehow slightly comic in effect.
Ruby is an extremely flawed narrator, so she is completely omniscient. She knows everything almost from the beginning of time to the end of time. And on the other hand, there's huge things that she doesn't know. So I think it's all part of her tricksiness as a narrator, that we feel we're in confident hands with her because she's telling us so much. And on the other hand, there's things that she's, well, things she can't tell us because she doesn't know. As opposed to, I don't think she's directly lying. So, but it was interesting to play around with the omniscience, the authorial omniscience, I think, because it was more fun in a way to undercut it a lot of the time.
And you did it you do it often with, well, like I was saying, sort of on the surface, if one were to paraphrase it, sad events. Mm. I mean, you know, the death of George is a comic thing, isn't it?
I don't do that anymore. I think I got it out of my system in a way. And I think I probably only would do it to characters I didn't like or characters I didn't have an emotional relationship with. Mm. So I wouldn't do it to characters that I valued more. So in a way, they get thrown away because I don't have enough respect for them, perhaps, as characters, I think. But also now that I've apparently become a crime writer, I treat death much more seriously than I did in this book, because this book is just a roll call of dead people,
in a way. I'm starting trying to count. It's incredible.
And I wasn't really aware of that when I was writing it. But then if you've got two world wars in a book, then you're going to get a lot of dead people, obviously. But I didn't intentionally set out to kill so many people in a book. But if you're killing that many people, I think you do become quite lighthearted about it because you're just dispatching people so fast in a way that, and yet that's not true because there is a terrible pain at the heart of some of those deaths particularly. But I mean, I think, you know, both her sister and her father, those deaths are very deeply felt. But her way of dealing with these things is to be very offhand about them, and that must surely come, I think, from her own true loss, where that has been so blanked out by her that you know she deals with death in a way that we wouldn't deal with death. Mm. I would like to think.
I mean, yes, you're very careful with Gillian to make sure that we only know her as this slightly malicious presence, and so it's difficult to feel. I mean, it's easy to laugh at that first mention of it, and then I don't think I later sort of feel great regret at having done it.
No, I don't honestly think I would write a character like that anymore. I think I would feel I would give them more of a place. I wouldn't be so cruel, I think, with a character now.
Perhaps, but you do that thing which is, but the cruelty, I suppose, you say it cruel. I mean, I mean, it's a cruelty you can get away with because it's sort of, there's that great bit for later on when we get to her death, when her two sisters, the narrator, Ruby and Patricia, are sort of taking it on board, as they say, and what they're thinking about is, what about those presents underneath the tree? Are they going to be half and half redistributed, or will they just disappear completely, which would be a waste, wouldn't it? But I mean, there is something appallingly credible about...
And yet underneath, I do think it's avoidance. They are avoiding what's happened. So there is so much avoidance in this book.
But I mean, when people in Middlemarch are waiting for somebody to die, they are all thinking equally sort of unpathetic things.
Aren't
they? I mean, it's not sort of, an honourable kind of novelistic tradition.
Yes, I think it's perfectly acceptable.
But it does have a sort of, I don't know, I found, especially I suppose second time round, I found some of the predictions of people's fates before perhaps we got to the bit where the fate was described. I suppose especially those characters like Ada or
Edmund,
though, who goes to Canada and then dies in.
But then she's talking about the past, so she knows the past. So she's writing in the future, but she's also writing with the past knowledge because she's writing from a very omniscient point because she's writing at the end.
Yes.
So that she does know these things. So in a way, it's a false narrator who hides these things from us, isn't it?
Of course. But she does hide. She hides a big thing.
She hides a very big thing.
Yes,
she hides a very,
she?
Very big thing, indeed. And a lot of the reason that she hides it is because I didn't know what it was for most of the book. I knew that Ruby had lost something tremendous and huge and incredibly vitally important, but I couldn't work out what that would be. And I always used to have this feeling, until I was well into my 40s, I felt that I'd forgotten something. And it was it's a very difficult feeling to explain because it's very disturbing. I mean, I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would think, I've almost got it. I almost remember it. What is it? What is it? Or sometimes I'd wake up and I think, oh God, I've forgotten it. It's so important. I've forgotten. Now I've forgotten. It was really very deep in my psyche. And maybe I have, maybe I haven't. I don't know. But it no longer affects me. I no longer ever think, oh God, I've forgotten something. Probably because my memory's now so short that it doesn't really. I've forgotten so much. But that feeling of something tremendously important that had been lost and forgotten. And I got right to the end of the book, really to the end of the book. And I thought, I have to work out what this is. This is ridiculous. What could it be that's driving her like this in the way that this thing drove me? And I thought, well, what is the worst thing that you can lose? And for me, I think because I'm a narcissistic person, well, apart from my children, the worst thing I could lose would be self. That to me would be that thing that would explain it. And I thought, but that's not it, that's not right. So what's the nearest thing to self? And the nearest thing to self is an identical twin. It's like the second self there. And if she lost that, then that would be a big enough loss to have driven this feeling right through this book, right through her life. And I'm one of those people, if I could have one thing, it would be an identical twin. And I say that to people and they all go, oh, I can't think of anything worse than that. And I just think, why not? Because you'd have another you. It would be so wonderful. Someone who understood you completely. And I think that's what she's lost. She's lost the person who understands her completely because nobody else in the book understands Ruby. She is absolutely that misunderstood Alice in Wonderland child. Nobody understands her. She is adrift in this world of adults who do lie to her because they keep that truth from her, I think. And so that's the very worst thing that can happen to you.
But it must have meant quite a bit of restitching because I've mentioned
seeding.
Clues.
It's called seeding. All right, apparently.
Okay. I'll tuck that one away. Seeding. I don't think that's in my dictionary of literary terms.
I believe it's a crime writer's term. But no, it actually took very little. It was very surprising because you would think you would have to sort of go back and put things in. But actually, it was all there. Right. There were very few things I had to put in.
I mean, I wanted to... I mean, maybe I should ask... You know, I shouldn't do this sort of thing. I mean, amongst those of you who've... I'm sure it's almost everybody here has read Behind the Scenes at the Museum. When you first read it, if you could remember, I wonder how many people here before the revelation of the existence of this twin... How many of you knew the revelation was coming, could see it coming? Nobody.
Oh, wow.
Nobody.
That's fantastic.
God, that's good, isn't it?
But I bet if I'd known that all along and I'd been writing knowing that, it would have been obvious, I think.
But I was going... Okay, second time round, reading it.
Okay.
Okay. There's talking about seeding. There's sort of... But perhaps these things weren't seeded. Perhaps they just... happened.
Oh, you like that word now, don't you?
Yeah, I like it. I'm going to use it. I'm going to claim it, make it my own, turn it over on my palate. There's different kind of clues. So reading it a second time, it seems to me there's some things which there's no way one could have noticed the first time. Mm-hmm. I don't know. When Ruby tells of asking her mum, Bunty, about the woman in the photograph who is Alice, who was she? And Bunty has a bit of a difficult time sort of remembering and explaining, but eventually she does get it out. There's a kind of uncertainty about who this woman was. Mm-hmm. And Bunty says, oh, she died. Didn't she say she died giving birth to Nell? Or after, I think she said she died, I can't remember now. But the uncertainty about it feels like a sort of just a bit of circumstantial, naturalistic detail. Or the little things about Ruby and her name. And when you find out that there's a matching twin who's got another precious name, sort of some of the things about this name start sort of making sense. But there's no way, I think, first time round you could see that. But then there are other things that even a sluggard like myself thought at the time, hang on, what's that about? Where, she says, why are we in Dewsbury? And then our mysterious exile in Dewsbury, which is where she's been sent after this terrible event, her twin sister's death. And at the time, I'm thinking there's a reason for this. Or the thing you've just talked about a feeling of something that's been forgotten. You put that very phrase into Ruby's mouth, sort of later, when they're talking about the ooze freezing. And so she says, suddenly I have this feeling of something long forgotten. And you think, what is that? There must be something. Is it that the second type of clue is seeded and the first type's not? Or did you think of kind of wanting to take it as close to nudging the reader as possible? Because some of those latter ones I've mentioned are quite big sort of clues, aren't they?
Well, the big clues are seeded, I think. I mean, right at the beginning when she's born.
Yes.
The doctor says snap. So ones like that have gone back and been put in.
But I didn't notice that. You say the doctor's surprise.
I know.
The doctor's surprise. Yeah. I didn't even notice. Yeah. Pathetic, hopeless. But then they didn't notice either, you see. And then she just describes herself in the womb. I feel that there's something about a shadow at my back.
A shadow stitched onto my back, yes. It's all there.
Yeah.
It's all there. No, it's a very interesting exercise to go back and do something like that, I think. But it's the emotions that were all there. The things were not, you know, so that in a way they were all just waiting to be slotted in.
And were you conscious of trying to, as it were, to do it so people wouldn't guess? I mean, it must be quite a... I can see that with a crime writer, it would become
I thought they were quite clunking clues, actually, but obviously not, because when she's doing the letters, isn't she? She's writing out the names, P-A-R, and all of these things. And I thought maybe they would be annoying because they weren't being explained at the time. There was always... But I thought the overall feeling that she gives off is of someone who's forgotten something, and there is always that sense of something being out of reach in the book, I think.
Yes.
So that it's all kind of part of an atmosphere rather than anything else,
yeah.
I think.
Well, you were very deft getting away. I mean, I suppose one thing that I think, which also I think you got away with, or you managed to do...
Because that's what we like us writers,
getting away with things. A trick you managed to pull as a result of that, which I think in a way maybe is even harder, was that there's a sort of... which is kind of from comedy to something incredibly sad, actually, which is, I think to do with Bunty, the character of Bunty, because... She's a sort of brilliant comic character, in a way, and sort of not unlovable, but you know, incredibly unsentimental, I think it's fair to say. And the final revelation means that we have to change what we think of her, I think, quite a lot. I don't know about other people, but I felt that quite strongly. I mean, we actually even have to change the way we think of something she said, know? Mm. And we have to think of her as a much less, you know, I suppose as a less ridiculous person than she has seemed. I mean, were you aware that was a kind of trick you were having to perform?
No, I mean, for me, she changes when she's at the end, when she has Alzheimer's and she's in the nursing home. Then you feel sorry for her. I think then Ruby feels something different for her. But I think my feeling about her was really that, yes, you can see that she had undergone something that you didn't know about that was obviously would make you more sympathetic to her, but actually, surely the terrible thing she did was to push the child away that she had, and that, you know, a three-year-old is necessarily completely innocent, and therefore she was a bad mother because she should have embraced that child, clearly, rather than sending her to Dewsbury, which, you know, is a pretty bad exile. Yes. So that for me, no, I never really forgave
her.
No.
Well, it's funny because I differ with you here. I know, obviously, you have the prerogative of the creator, but it did feel like, to me, like a kind of real, you know, that way when they're writing a sonnet, a volta, where you suddenly turn. Oh, no, I'm going to see things a different way. And... you know, like when, I don't know, if you find it too grand a comparison, like when exactly sort of George Eliot suddenly tells you you've got to start feeling sorry for Casaubon. you know, because actually, here's what's going on in his head. Mm. Here's his history. And you suddenly think, oh, I've been a bit bad, actually. I've been laughing at him and mocking at him and thinking he's awful. And actually, you know, to know all is to forgive all. Sort of that. And I felt a bit like that with Bunty.
I think you give him, or I give him more layers, certainly. But, I mean, I still sort of take Ruby's side, as it were, against Bunty, I think.
Well, let me ask you about the... We were having about what perhaps you thought was the wrong way of describing the novel. I described it as, in some ways, I perhaps now you see licensed by my mother's verdict, a family saga. And you were saying that you thought that was the wrong way of describing it.
I don't know. I always find when people say family saga, it sounds to me like a pejorative term. Mm. And I don't know why, because maybe I'm being snobbish about literature, because I don't think there should be that great literary populist divide in books anyway. You know, good book's a good book. So I don't know why I feel, but there's something about, I think it's because other people use it in a vaguely pejorative term. And I don't really know what a saga is, because I just think it's something Icelandic.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it applies to...
I think it's a really big influence of the sort of dim folk memory, probably for lots of people in this audience, of the Forsyte saga on British television. Because actually, once upon a time, I think you could write, you know, Thomas Mann wrote a brilliant saga, Buddenbrooks, which is kind of fantastically sort of high literature. But I think people do have a sense that it's a sort of, it's genre fiction sagas, and which I think is totally unfair.
And also, but after the Whitbread, it was working class family saga, which made it sound even more somehow.
I didn't say that, did I? No, I don't think I did say that.
You didn't say
but
that.
But I meant that it does something. I mean, I would sort of define it very... You do it structurally in a very unusual way, but this structure of a sort of narration in the present tense and these footnotes taking us, plunging us back into the history of members of her family. But a family saga, I'd say, is just simply a work of fiction which takes us beyond one or two generations. I mean, takes us beyond the lifespan of one group of characters, essentially.
Okay.
Right. So even if it's fallen into kind of sort of disrepute or something, perhaps one of the reasons that it has is it has that thing which, actually, on telly at least, the Forsyte saga had for people like of my parents' generation, which was you were absorbed in a whole thing and characters died and you mourned them, but life went on and then their children grew up and that's...
I mean, my original concept for the novel, you know, the very, 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 very beginning... was that I wanted to take a family from the beginning of time to the end of time, which was really quite a big sweep. And then I realised that didn't really work, and I narrowed it down to a living set of generations, so that people who would be within living memory or the people who were just slipping out of living memory, like Alice, the great-grandmother, so that... And moving slightly forward into sending off another generation who you don't ever get to know much about. So it was a kind of practicality that made it those people in a way. Mm. But then that made more sense because it covered such an important period of time. But it was also, I felt in a way I was working within my living memory because I feel as if I remember things I don't because I've got them from the people who do remember them. All those, you know, there's periods of time that have just gone, those things you've just missed. I mean, I've always felt I just missed the war because I was born in 1951 and I feel that very much, that somehow, you know, it's like, drat, I missed it. It was just there. and so that it was just keeping it within those parameters. But really, in a way, I didn't think I am writing about a family so much as I just thought I'm writing about people because the family is a very convenient way of grouping characters, but it's also the most ferocious dynamic you'll ever have within a group of people, I think. So I just didn't... A lot of what I was doing, I think a lot of the time I actually find I look back and I think, oh, I didn't realise I was doing that. And I realise that writing is an incredibly unconscious process. You just don't notice what it is that you're doing. And sometimes you look at things and you think, goodness me, I write a lot about that. I didn't realise I wrote a lot about that. So in a way, I was writing about people set against history, and they just necessarily were in a family, as opposed to thinking, I'm going to write about a family, which I think is a different thing.
But that, I mean, the book, despite its comedy, some of the sort of poignancy, if that's the right word. Mm. That's probably sounds a bit pejorative as
no,
well.
No, I like no poignancy. Poignancy's a good word. Okay. I like poignancy.
Well, some of the poignancy of it does come from the fact that you go across generation upon that you do four generations, so that particularly I think second time round, you know, I was reading a bit I hardly noticed, which I think is in which is in the first or second chapter, where we get the photograph of Alice, Ruby says, Bunty says, your Uncle Tom had it in his nursing home when he died. And it's yet another death. And second time round, it feels like an incredibly poignant thing, because first time round I didn't notice this is a photo. Oh, what's the photo of? This is going to be important. Mm. But I didn't notice poor old Uncle Tom.
With his wooden hand.
With this photo. But then chapters upon chapters on, generations upon generations back, you know, there's him as a child being left by his mother and being told a sort of full story and never knowing the real truth, although we do. And that wouldn't carry its emotional freight if you weren't going over, I think. You know, that's maybe one of the things that sort of... That family sagas have always had a kind of electricity because they can do that.
Mm. No, that's true. That's true. I give you the word, along with seeding.
Oh, seeding. Look, I've got sort of about a quarter of the way through my questions, but I've already been told I mustn't go too far and give everybody else a chance. So have we got the mic? So please, anybody here, if you'd like to ask Kate a question or make a comment or say anything about the novel, please, who'd like to start? Yes, the lady there.
One of the characters I really loved was Teddy. And in fact, Teddy seems to be more alive than any of the pets in the pet shop, apart from the parrot. But we never found out what happened to Teddy after the hallucinogenic time that Ruby had in the airing cupboard after she'd taken the overdose. And I wondered if you had planned an ending for Teddy as well.
Well, Teddy actually sits on the end of my bed with my cat. it's very funny. Teddy, I had a Teddy that I was given when I was 3 months old, and he was my Winnicottian transitional object. I loved my Teddy in a way that no child has ever loved a Teddy, because he was very, very, very important to me. In the maelstrom of family life, Teddy was my constant. And my daughters have an instruction that in my coffin has to go the ashes of my cat and my teddy bear, because he had such emotional significance for me that it was wonderful to find a place for him to have emotional significance for someone else. And so when she meets him again and when she drops down the well, I thought that was, to me, that was wonderful that she then met him again and that he had a voice and that he spoke and that he had this kind of reality. I am sure, although there is no reality beyond the text and we must never forget that, but I'm sure that Teddy sits on the end of Ruby's bed even now, completely bald and eyeless and pathetic, but still... as a kind of a memory of an emotion that has powered her life, I think.
He has quite a mischievous role as well, doesn't he? Because
he's quite a
when he
boy.
Goes missing and she finds her father, she finds these jaw, isn't it, when she's looking for the teddy?
I think she's looking for the Mobo horse, which was also a very significant item for many people of my age, I have to say.
Yes, there's a gentleman at the... If you want to be after this gentleman, you could stick your hand up now so we know where we're going next.
Okay, you said that you like objects, and some people like them to own them or to share them or to organise them. Why do you like objects?
Organise them? There's a thought. Why do I like objects? I like objects, a lot of objects, because they're beautiful. I like the aesthetics of certain objects, you know, that you look at something and you think that's so lovely. On the other hand, I do think it's what they carry, so the things that you remember. I mean, I'm trying to think of objects in my house and how I look at them and what they mean. And I think a lot of the time, they're just... A lot of things I have mean continuity, so that I have things I've had since, well, not since I was a child, that say my parents had when I was a child that I now have. So to me, in a way, those objects are little anchors, because I can look at, I don't know, a ship in a bottle that I have and think, I've been looking at that since I was born, basically, so that there's something there that remains and carries on. And I think I like that solidity of objects. And of course, all objects, particularly things like ships in bottles, carry the terror that they will, in fact, break because they're very fragile. So objects also, within them, they carry their own kind of destruction, I think, because, you know, therefore you can never feel that you can rely on them. You're going to ask me something else.
Is it fair to draw a parallel between the characters in your books and the objects in the way that you're describing them, particularly thinking about this fragility?
How do you mean? No, give it to him back.
It's holding the conch. I'm just scared. I want to pass it to the next boy.
The objects and the characters, in what way? For me, you mean? Or
well, the way you've described objects is, yes, is showing continuity and going back to the way you feel about your parents and so on. Is that the way you feel about the characters in your books? Are they giving you continuity? You talked just now about almost events being more important as a background for your characters than their families.
No, I think it's what they carry. Well, yeah, maybe that's the same thing. What they carry with them is that the characters in this book gave me a place to put things. You were saying that you're from Sheffield. In here, there's one of my father's memories that he told me was that he came up from the pit one morning after doing a night shift. Well, it was still dark, and because it was December, I think, and he saw a glow in the sky, and he said to his workmate, you know, what is that? And he said, that's Sheffield burning, lad. And that was the big raid on Sheffield. And I've always found that a very moving memory, completely unattached to me. I mean, I'm, you know, as I say, I missed the war. And but to me, my father's memory would be lost forever if it didn't find a place. And I used to work with old people, and, you know, what old people want to do is talk to you. And I always used to just listen like a vulture, because I'm thinking, this is before I was a writer, really, was these memories are going to be lost. And I think, for me, there's a lot of other people's memories, as well as mine in this book, that I felt were now safe. I think that was a very important feeling with this book to me, that they had become objects, because this is an object, and it'll go on, probably outlive me, if I'm lucky. And
if it's on the A-level syllabus.
If it's on the A-level syllabus, in the way that... you know, the Wuthering Heights has outlived Emily Bronte, and all the things that she put in there that were important to her, and all the chaos of her thoughts have been made objective in this thing that's really neat. You know, it's just small and neat, and it contains all of those things. And so a lot of the objects and the memories and the personal little things all have a place, and therefore they're safe, I think. And I do feel that very much about that book, that it keeps things safe and not just... not just for me, but for...
The BBC has done an awesome People's Archive about the Second World War, which clearly seems to interest you as well. When are you going to write one of your fantastic books about that period of history?
About the Second World War. It's not the next book, it's not the book after that, and it's probably not the book after that, but it's the book after that. And it's a very high concept
too
book.
Too late. I've got a novelist who plans four books.
Oh, at least, at least. When I don't have any more books backed up, I'll be ready to die, presumably. So, yes. But I will, I do. Yes, I really do want to write about the war. Yes.
When I read this book, it seemed to carry me away with such enormous high spirits. Mm. It was so enjoyable to read something that was written with such joie de vivre. Now, it was your first novel. Was it easy to write? Have your later novels been more difficult?
That's a very good question, because I was thinking about that today, and I think I thought about it for a very long time before I wrote it, a lot longer than I normally think about a book before I write it, because I didn't have a publisher and I wasn't really writing and I was doing other things, and it was always, you know, so I did think about it more. So that when I came to write it, it's certainly the fastest book I've ever written. I think I had about 6 chapters when it was bought, and it was, I signed the contract in January, I think, and I think I delivered by about May. It was very, 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 very fast. And it was easy to write because I didn't have any... I suppose part of me just thought it might be the only book I ever write. I didn't really think in terms of there's a whole career behind this. I mean, yes, that's what you would like to think. But in a way, I was putting everything into this book. So it was kind of gushing, for want of a better word, and I think it has a kind of a brio about it, and as you said, Augusta, I think you're right. It's a kind of first novel thing. It's like it's all been waiting to be written, and suddenly you're writing it. So it's written in a very different way from, although I wrote it with a contract, and therefore people paid you money and expected it to be delivered, it still had that feeling of, now I get to write it. Whereas now it's more, you kind of think, I'm supposed to write a book now because that's what I'm supposed to do. And although you still have, I still have, lots of things I want to write about, it doesn't quite have that, now I get to write this book finally. So that I think it has a kind of energy in it that I can never replicate, because nobody can ever replicate the energy of that first book. And we did it, we've talked a lot about grief and loss and misery, but actually it's a very, I think it's a book that is very, for want of a better term, life-affirming. I think it is all about coming through and soldiering on and finding the good in things and finding a redemption for yourself and at the same time learning to be happy, I suppose, I think.
There's a lady just behind you, Jenny, and then there's the lady right at the back.
And there was that man right there in front of that lady.
Yes, you get your chance.
The twin character is sort of normally conceptualised as being something quite evil, and especially in a crime genre, I'm thinking of Ruth Rendell's The Double in particular. And I was wondering if the twin presence in the book could be seen as something quite malevolent, sort of be connected to the death throughout the book, as opposed to just something sad and there's something that she's missing.
I think, well, she's not an evil twin, that's for sure. She's the exact opposite of that. She's more like an angelic twin in some ways, I suppose. But she is the good, I think for Ruby, the problem is that it's as if the good person died and the bad person stayed alive, so that she suffers a great deal from that. And, you know, Ruby is a pearl, which is white, and pearl is a pearl, which is white, and Ruby's red, which is, you know, the colour of kind of danger and evil. And so I think there's a sense that she's almost too good. There's that kind of purity about it, because she never got to live. She died at the age of absolute innocence. So she's a little too good in a way, and she's the exact opposite of the evil twin. I hadn't really thought about that, but she is the purely good.
Were you thinking of the other twins as well? The lady who asked the question, were you thinking of Daisy and Rose?
Oh, the flower twins, yes. No, they're just evil.
But it's quite naughty. It's quite naughty what you do, isn't it? Because I've just looked where they first come in the novel, and it says Bunty's sister Babs comes to visit all the way from Dewsbury with her twins, Daisy and Rose. And then these twins, and I remember thinking at the time, oh, these twins, what part are they going to be? And the second time, when I reread it, I read it like this, Bunty, in my head, Bunty's sister Babs comes to visit all the way from Dewsbury with her twins, you know? Mm. And I mean, it's one of those kind of things that you could call a clue next time round, but you can possibly sort of get first time. Mm. Sorry, anyway, there's a lady at the...
The setting of the story in York seems quite significant. Is that just because it's a city you know well, or is it because it's so historical and therefore full of ghosts in itself as the story?
It is historical and full of ghosts, but I think for me, I mean, I used to feel very nostalgic about the fact that I didn't... No, not that I did. I used to feel very nostalgic about York. Those were the feelings I had. It was nostalgia. And the fact that I didn't live in Yorkshire, I don't live in Yorkshire, I feel quite a pain of that. That I lived, in fact, in another country, because I lived in Scotland, and I think it used to be quite an active feeling. And it was interesting, after I wrote the book, I never ever felt that again. It was a true catharsis. But I think there's a lot of my feelings about York in this book. I think it's a very, for me, I couldn't have written this, it has to be written in York. There is no other place for this book to take place, because I was very aware of the history of York as a child. I lived in Stonegate, and my parents' shop was in Stonegate, which is, you know, the oldest street in York. I was right at the very heart of all of that history, and York is very... to have been brought up in York in the 50s, you were very aware of that history, without the tourists, because the tourists didn't really come until the 60s. So it was almost like it was yours, that those streets were yours, and that you were aware of those stones, and that it was a very resonant childhood, I think, all of that history. We lived in an incredibly old, the shop was in a very, very, very old building. There was always this sense of ancientness everywhere. And I think there is, it's part of it. There's absolutely intertwined with it. There is no other place for this book to have taken place because this was my childhood. You know, Ruby's childhood is my childhood in that sense, in its in where it's placed. And it was my hint to York in a way, I think, to that York. Perhaps not the York now, but you know, to that lost York, I think.
There's a gentleman at the front, Ginny, or not right at the front.
Yeah. Slightly motivated question. In your experiences in York, one part of it was being at Queen Anne's School, from which you got some very rich comic material.
Did you teach me?
No. Not exactly.
Not exactly.
But what I was going to ask was, when you sat there behind your desk, were you actually aware that you were collecting comic material? Is that something that you've been doing through your life?
I've been collecting material throughout my life, and a lot of the time unconsciously, but not so much at school. I'm thinking a lot about school at the moment because we have a 45-year school reunion next week. I know, the class of 63. So that, and I think I was very unaware of anything comical at school, to be honest. So that, in a way, interesting question, isn't it? I'm a voyeur. I'm one of nature's voyeurs. I am an observer. I just look all the time. And I think now I can see what a rich vein was there. And I wish I'd paid more attention. But that's the same about university. I think, gosh, I wish I'd paid more attention then too. And
but you've put that into fiction,
yes,
too, haven't you?
Yes. And I wish I'd kept a really rigorous diary from the age of 5. That would be the one thing. If I could go back, it would have been to have kept a diary. So I have a diary for 1 year, which is 62 to 63. And it starts off very full of good intentions, as all diaries do. And then it sort of tapers into, like, all people's diaries of that age, because I'd be 10, 11. No, it was my first year at Queen Anne Grammar School. So I'd be 11, coming on 12. And it's like, ate an apple and an orange today. And it's just like, I think even that to me is very precious, that somehow that person that I've now lost but is still me ate an apple and an orange on the 3rd of November or whatever. You know, and there's all sorts of interesting things in. I look at it, it's very sparsely, you know, entered, but it's like, Mummy wasn't very well today. Mummy's still not very well. And I'm thinking, this is interesting because I don't remember my mother ever being ill. And then I think there's a secret messages in there that I don't remember. Or, you know, Mummy went to the theatre, Mummy not very well, Mummy's still not very well. I ate an apple and an orange. It's just so, and you can't, and I wish I'd just kept these really rigorous diary entries because it would be, I have a terrible memory. People are always saying to me, oh, you have a wonderful memory. I'm like, my family would snort at that fact because I remember nothing, absolutely nothing. There are vast years of my children's life that I've forgotten. And I remember no names whatsoever. People are always saying to me, friends are always saying to me, do you remember when we did that? And it's like, it'll be something quite important. And I'll go, no. And they'll go, no, you don't, do you? And I'm going, no, I don't. What I have a memory is what things felt like. I remember atmospheres. I can remember meals I ate 40 years ago, but I can't remember who I ate them with. It's a feeling about things that I can remember. So I remember so much about school, and yet so little of it I could actually say what it was that I remember. I have a very odd memory. I have a hallucinatory sense memory. I conjure up smells. So I'm always going, can you smell that smell of roast beef? And people go, no, you're imagining it. So that I think I have an overstimulated smell memory, as it were, and that olfactory memory.
Is that why you mentioned the roasted meat? The one in the novel, you talk about the pets who die in the fire.
If you look very closely at all my books, you will find they are absolutely full of dead flesh and carnivorous behavior. I've been a vegetarian for 30 years. My books are full of dead flesh. It's really alarming.
So the horrid butcher, that's all subtle propaganda, isn't it?
No, not at all.
The lustful butcher.
I have nightmares about eating meat. I think it's a very deep fear of being a cannibal, I've decided. So what, why are you asking me about Queen Anne Grammar School? No. I want to know why this gentleman's asking me about Queen Anne Grammar School. Are you asking me about Queen Anne Grammar School?
You said it's a motivated question.
Yes. Did you?
I worked there at the time that Kate was at school there, but I can confess never to have taught her. So for one reason or another, I take no responsibility.
What subject did you teach?
I taught English.
What's your name, Mr.?
My name's Peter Griffith.
Mr. Griffith.
Sorry, I didn't mean to drag that in. I was more interested in a straight, untampered with answer to that question. I'm not sure I got it.
You've worn very well, Mr. Griffith.
I would like to say the same of you. And
it was a very good school. I learned a lot there, but at the time I really hated it. But it was.
Ginny, that's right.
You said at the beginning that you were apparently a crime writer now. did you not intend your last two books to be crime novels, or do you not want to be a crime novelist?
I mean, I'm very flattered to be considered a crime writer. I don't think it's my job to decide what genre I'm in. I think life would be much better if there was no such thing as genre, so that everyone was just...
Oh, I'd be out of a job. It'd be terrible. Say what genre, that's what I do, that's my only raison d'etre.
Well, you know, a book is a book is a book, and when I write a book, I just feel I'm writing a book that I'm writing. You know what I mean? It's my book that I'm writing. But I am aware that once you start putting detective figures in books, they become crime novels, because that's almost inevitable. But it's not how I feel what I'm writing. I just feel I'm writing another book in a way. But I know it's a particular kind of book, and it's not like that book, I know, but... So, I am aware of genre. I mean, it's disingenuous to say I'm not, but I don't feel like a crime writer. I think that's the best answer to that. It's just I feel like a writer, which is, you know.
There's a lady here.
I can't help feeling that you might like to write a biography. I wondered who it might be if you did.
Oh, good Lord, what a question. I don't think I would, because I don't... I don't think I like biography. I think it's because I've always had a terror that someone might write mine, and then my children would have to kill them, because I think it's just... I don't know. There is no one I would like to write... No, that's a really interesting question. No.
I think that's why my mum loved the book so much. She sort of thought it's got the pleasures of both, which was her favourite genre.
Without.
There's a gentleman there.
In Behind the Scenes and some of your earlier novels, women do take the main role, some of them sympathetic. In your more recent novels, you allow men to have a more central role, and they too even managed to be sympathetic. Have you discovered more recently a way of feeling sympathetic about men?
No. I've always felt sympathetic towards men. That's wrong, isn't it? I've always seen us as equals. But I think, just lack of confidence, I think, that I just never felt that I could write a male character, because I think it's very difficult to write across gender and to get it right, and that therefore I didn't want to say that, because I think it's, for me, it's, I don't, if I'm writing about a woman or writing in a woman's voice, writing a woman character, I don't even think about it. Nothing comes up. I just write it because I feel that I absolutely know what it's like to be inside a woman's head, because I am. But with men, then you start thinking, well, would they think that? Well, how would they think? Well, you know, you've got to go through all of those processes. And I didn't feel confident enough as a writer to realize that it is all fiction after all, you know, whoever's head you're in. And then once I'd made that decision, and that came from writing Case Sisters, which was a crime novel because it had a detective in, and at the point I thought, I want a proper conventional detective and he's going to be a man, that I just thought, no, I can do this. I just have to sort of get the right accoutrements for him, you know, give him the right kits and the right way of thinking, and then sort of send him off and he'll be fine. And now I feel much more confident about that. And it's the same with dialogue. If you look at Behind the Scenes, it's very, very little dialogue in there. Whereas now I feel really happy about writing dialogue. So it's just a kind of evolution, I think.
Ah, there's a lady at the back.
I think the scene where Ruby responds to the hypnotherapist with her final revelation, and she goes through the list of everybody who supported this person, and then the therapist says something about, will we go through the whole list and ever get to poor Ruby, is one of the most affecting scenes I've ever read.
Well, I
cried very deeply, and I think most people in this room maybe cried as well. And I was wondering what it was like to write. Was it as deeply affecting to write
it
that
It was
bit?
Quite an affecting passage. Yes, I'd forgotten that, actually. That it was, yes, I did feel it was quite powerful. Although the only scene that I cried at when I wrote, because sometimes I do cry when I write, was when the dogs are killed in the First World War. And that I can't even read that because I think that's the saddest thing in the book, which says something about me. But I did. No, I did think that was very powerful because it was coming to something that I thought was such a point. And I think I felt it too, in a way. I think we all feel that in a way, don't we? It's like, well, you know, what about me? Because we don't think like that. So yes, no, it's true. I think it was powerful to write. I like writing things that are powerful to write. That sounds stupid, but so much of writing is even when it feels very creative, that's what it feels like. It feels like you're writing, and you might look at something and think, oh, I like that sentence, or that's a good word, or can I make that sentence better, or can I find an internal rhyme for that, or can I? And so it's very sort of, I was going to use the word meaty, but I should try and avoid that word, I think. But it's very physical. So a lot of the time you're not writing emotional scenes in books anyway. So when you do, and you actually feel it yourself, it does have a really good authenticity that you kind of think, oh yes, that has a more real feel in a way than a lot of, because all the time you're making things up after all. You know.
I'm sure there's plenty of novelists who don't ever think that, you know. You're like sort of, you know, Dickens used to weep when he wrote the weepy bits, you know.
Oh yeah, because if they're not going to move you, then they're not going to move anyone, are they? I think
we've got time for one more. That the lady there, bring down the curtain.
Although a lot of horrible things do happen in your books, as a reader I feel quite safe reading them, because there is quite a strong moral compass and quite a lot of justice and karma and rightness with the world. That, you know, some authors, when horrible things happen, you really don't want to read anymore because you're going to feel frightened at the end of it about the terror that is the world. But why do you think you have this sort of moral compass and karma? Is it religious? Is it a moral kind of center?
It's because I read all the time throughout my childhood from a very early age, because I learned to read when I was nearly four, and I learned exactly as Ruby does with the Ladybird Book of Puppies and Kittens. And I remember the very moment when I learned to read, the very moment when I read This Is a Puppy and thought, oh, I get it. And but what I read mostly was fairy stories, and in fairy stories, real right justice always pervades. That, you know, that there is the morality of fairy stories is so strong that I think it was patterned into my brain that I truly believe that that's how the world was, that, you know, cosmic justice would see to everybody and the good would be rewarded and the evil would be punished. And though I no longer entirely think that, I still think I do, really, deep somewhere inside of me. And I think it particularly shows in my writing. It might not necessarily show so much in my life, but I think it particularly shows in my writing that that is something that I think I adhere to in all my books. And I don't think about it, actually. It just seems to me that's what should be in a book, because that's what were in the books that I read so much as a child.
So even that Hillman Husky is a sort of instrument of divine justice.
We had that Hillman Husky, that family car. Yes, well, yes, with Julian, yeah, she had to die.
Well, thank you very much, everybody here,
thank you for coming
and
into the crypt. This is very good for Halloween, isn't it, being in a crypt.
And Kate will sign some books if you would like that. But so all that's left for me to do is just to thank her very much for coming and talking to
me. And thank you for talking to me as well.
<That's all right>.